Chapter 12. I did what any sane person would do in a situation like that. I threw myself to the ground.
Oh, honestly, Dresden,
Sir Stuart snapped. He sprinted toward the gunfire out through the wall of the house. I actually saw the building's wards flare up with spectral blue-white light around him as he went through unimpeded.
Right, dummy, I growled at myself. You're already dead.
I got up and ran after the elder shade. The living were all kissing the hardwood floor as I plunged into the wall of the house. I wasn't worried about the wards keeping me in. No one ever designed their wards so that bad things couldn't leave, only so that they couldn't enter. Besides, I'd had an invitation to come in, which technically made me a friendly. But I found out that friendly wards operated on much the same principle as friendly fire. Going out through the warded wall didn't just tingle unpleasantly. I felt like I just plunged naked down a water slide lined with steel wool.
Ah!
I screamed, emerging from the wards and onto Murphy's front lawn, chock full of new insight as to why ghosts are always moaning or wailing when they come popping out of somebody's wall or floor. Not much mystery there. It freaking hurts. I staggered for several steps and looked up in time to see the drive-by still in progress. They were in a pickup truck. Someone in the passenger's compartment had the barrel of a shotgun sticking out the window, and four figures in dark clothing crouched in the truck's cargo bed, pointing what looked like assault weapons and submachine guns at Murphy's house. They were cutting loose with them, too, flashes of thunder and lightning too bright and loud to be real, seemingly magnified by the quiet, still air between the snow and the streetlights. These guys weren't real pros. I'd seen true professional gunmen in action. And these jokers didn't look anything like them. They just pointed the business end more or less in a general direction and sprayed bullets. It wasn't the disciplined fire of true professionals, but if you throw out enough bullets, you're bound to hit something. Bullets went through me, half a dozen flashes of tingling discomfort, too brief to be more than an annoyance, and I suddenly found myself sprinting toward the truck beside Sir Stuart, exhilarated. Being bulletproof is kind of a rush.
What are we doing? I shouted at him. I mean, what are we accomplishing here? We can't do anything to them, can we? Watch and learn, lad, Sir Stuart called, his teeth bared in a wolfish grin. On three, be on the truck.
What?
I think... Don't think, the shade shouted. Just do it. Let your instincts guide you. Be on the truck. One, two...
The shade's feet struck the ground hard twice, like a long jumper at the end of his approach. I followed Sir Stuart's example on little more than reflex. A sudden memory flashed into my head. A school playground from my childhood, where mock Olympic games were being run, students competing against one another. The sun was hot above us, making the petroleum smell of warm asphalt rise from the surface of the playground. I'd been competing in the running long jump, and it hadn't been going well. I forget exactly why I was so desperate to win, but I was fixated on it, as only a child could be. I remembered willing myself to win, to run faster, to jump farther, as I sprinted down the lane toward the pink chalk jump line. It was the first time I used magic. I had no idea at the time, naturally, but I remembered the feeling of utter elation that flooded through me, along with an invisible force that pushed against my back as I leapt, and for just an instant I thought I had spontaneously learned to fly like Superman. Reality reasserted itself in rapid order. I fell, out of control, my arms spinning like a windmill. I went down on the blacktop and left generous patches of skin on its surface. I remember how much it hurt, and how I didn't care, because I'd won. I broke the Iowa State High School long jump record by more than a foot. It didn't stick, though. They disqualified me. I hadn't even gotten serious about puberty yet. Clearly something irregular had happened. Mistakes had been made, and surely the best thing was to ignore the anomalous leap. It was a vivid recollection, silly and a little sad, and it was my first time. It was a powerful memory.
Three!
Sir Stuart cried. And leapt. So did I, my eyes and will locked on the retreating pickup full of gunmen. There was a twisting, dizzying sensation that reminded me very strongly of a potion Bob had helped me mix up when I'd tangled with the Shadow Man. It was that same experience, a feeling of flying apart into zillions of pieces, rushing forward at a speed too great to be measured, only to abruptly coalesce again. There was a sudden cold wind against my face, and I staggered, nearly falling off the roof of the pickup as it continued to slowly accelerate down the street.
"Holy crap!"
I said as a huge smile stretched my face. "That was cool! First Shadowcat, now Nightcrawler!" I turned to find Sir Stuart standing on the bed of the truck, looking up at me with a disapproving eyebrow lifted. One of the shooter's backs was in the same space as the Shade's right leg. "Doesn't that hurt?" I asked him, nodding to his leg.
"Hmm,"
Sir Stuart said. He glanced down and saw what I was talking about.
"Oh, I suppose, yes. I stopped noticing it after 70 or 80 years. Now, if you don't mind, Dresden, might we proceed?"
"To do what?" I asked.
"To teach you what are obviously badly needed lessons," Sir Stuart said. "And to stop these pirates."
He spat the last word with a startling amount of venom. I frowned and eyed the gunmen, who were all reloading, having emptied their weapons in sheer nervous excitement. They weren't particularly good at reloading, either.
"Hell, one man with a handgun could take them all right now," I said. "Too bad neither of us has one."
"We cannot touch flesh," Sir Stuart said. "And while it is possible for a Shade to, for example, move an object, it is impractical. With practice, you could push a penny across a table over the course of a couple of minutes."
"Too bad neither of us has a penny," I said.
He ignored me entirely.
"That's because we can put forth only minuscule physical force. You couldn't lift a coin into the air against the pull of gravity."
I frowned. This sounded a lot like a basic lesson most young wizards received. Most of the time, when you wanted to move something around, you didn't have the kind of energy you needed stored inside you. That didn't mean you couldn't move it, though. It just meant you had to get the energy to do so from another source.
"But you can co-opt energy from elsewhere."
The big man pointed an index finger at me, a smile stretching his mouth.
"Excellent. We cannot interact with something being moved by a living creature. We can't even touch an object that is being carried too closely to a living body. But,"
he glanced up at me, inviting me to finish the thought. I blinked twice, mind racing, and said,
"Machines. We can work with machines."
Sir Stuart nodded.
"As long as they are in motion. And there is an enormous amount of energy in motion passing through a non-living mechanical engine."
Without another word, he paced forward through the back wall of the cab, sat on the passenger's seat, and leaned to his left. I couldn't see what he was doing, so I dropped to all fours, took a deep breath, and stuck my face through the roof of the cab. It tingled and hurt, but I had literally spent a lifetime learning to cope with pain. I pushed it to the back of my mind, gritted my teeth, and watched. Sir Stuart had pushed his hand into the steering wheel of the truck. He pushed the other forward, leaning partly through the dashboard to do it, and waited patiently, watching the road ahead of us. It didn't take long for the truck to hit a hummock in the ice coating the streets, and the truck bounced, shocks squealing. Just as it did, the Shade's eyes fluttered closed, and he gave a peculiar jerking twist of his arm. The truck's airbag exploded out of the steering wheel. It struck the driver, smacking him back into the driver's seat, and the man panicked. His arms tightened in surprise as he was hit, and he turned the steering wheel several degrees to one side. Then he broke the cardinal rule of driving on ice and stomped his foot on the brake. The slight turn and the sudden braking motion put the car into a slide. The driver was trying to push the airbag out of his face, and he didn't compensate and turn into the slide. The slide became a spin. Sir Stuart watched in satisfaction, looked up at me, and said,
"Not much different from spooking a horse, really."
The gunmen in the back were screaming in confusion as the car spun through three ponderous circles, somehow putting forth the illusion of grace. They bounced off the snow, piled high on one side of the street, and then slid into an intersection, up over a sidewalk, and through the front windows of a small grocery store. The sounds of shattering glass and brick, screaming metal crumpling through its zones, and cracking snow and ice were shockingly loud. The steadily ringing bell of the store's security alarm sounded like my old Mickey Mouse alarm clock in comparison. The gunman sat there doing nothing for a moment, clearly stunned, but then they began cursing and scrambling to get gone before the cops showed up. Sir Stuart vanished and reappeared across the street. I made the same effort of will I had while jumping to the truck, reaching back for that memory once more. Again, I flew apart and came back together, reappearing, standing next to Sir Stuart, facing a brick wall. "Next time, turn around on the way," he advised. I snorted and looked back at the gunman. "What about them?"
"What about them?
Can't we, I don't know, possess them and make them bang their heads into a wall or something?" Sir Stuart barked out a harsh laugh. "We cannot enter unless the mortal is willing. That is the purview of demons, not shades." I scowled. "So what? We stand here and watch them walk?" He shrugged. "I'm not willing to leave Mortimer alone for so much time. You may also wish to consider, Dresden, that dawn is not far away. It will destroy you if you are not within a sanctum, such as Mortimer's residence." I frowned, looking up at the sky. City light had wiped away all but the brightest stars, but the sky to the east held only a hint of blue, low on the horizon. Dawn was hard on spirits and shades and magical spells alike. Not because one is inherently good and one inherently evil, but because dawn is a time of new beginnings, and the light of a new day tends to sweep away the supernatural litter from the day before. For spirit beings to survive sunrise, they had to be in a protected place, a sanctum. My trusty lab assistant, Bob, had a sanctum, in his case, a specially enchanted skull designed to protect him from dawn and daylight, and to provide a home. A plain old threshold wouldn't get it done, although my old apartment had probably qualified as a sanctum, given how many layers and layers of defense I'd put up around it. But I didn't have either of those things anymore. "Go back to Mort," I said. "It was fun playing maximum overdrive with these chowderheads, but that isn't going to protect the people we care about. I'm going to follow the shooters back to their place and see what I can find out about them." Sir Stuart frowned at me and said, "The dawn is not something to take chances with, man. I strongly advise against your doing so." "So noted," I said. "But the only real weapon I have against them is knowledge. Someone needs to get it, and I'm the only one who isn't susceptible to lead poisoning. I'm the logical choice." "Assume you get the information and manage to survive the dawn," the shade said. "Then what will you do?" "I give it to Murphy, who uses it to rip the bad guys' tongues out through their belly buttons." Sir Stuart blinked. "That is certainly a vivid image." "It's a gift," I said modestly. He shook his head and sighed. "I admire your spirit, man, but this is foolish." "Yeah, but I've got to be me," I said. Sir Stuart put both hands behind his back and tapped a toe on the ground a few times. Then he gave me a resigned nod. "Good hunting," he said. "If you have a problem with wraiths again, vanish. They won't be able to keep up." "Thank you," I said, and offered him my hand. We traded grips, and he turned on a heel and started marching back toward Murphy's place. I watched him for a moment, then turned around and hurried after the snow-blurred forms of the gunman, wondering exactly how much time I had left before the sunrise obliterated me.